Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Movies and Meal, a podcast where we talk about movies and other things while we eat. I'm your co-host Ben, and as always, I'm joined by Keith.
Hey.
And Brad.
What's up?
We got a couple movies to actually review this week, but I think first Keith is going to just summarize his virtual Sundance experience, and then we're going to talk about two movies. First, we're going to talk about You People, a Netflix movie starring Jonah Hill and Eddie Murphy and some other people. And then we're going to close it out. Keith and I saw M. Night Shyamalan's latest, A Knock at the Cabin, with Dave Bautista. Well, Dave Bautista is really the headliner. Yeah. There's some other guys like Jonathan Goff that, you know, strangely enough, Rupert Grint, a.k.a. Ron Weasley. But
Rupert Grint comeback.
Yeah. I guess before anything, why don't we just have Keith here summarize what his experience was. You know, the last couple of years we've done virtual. I just couldn't do it this year. I've just been busy with a lot of things. But Keith, you actually had time to see some more movies, so tell us
about it. Yeah, you know, I tried to get you to do it, but, you know, I can understand why you didn't. But also, you know, this is the year they really cut back on virtual offerings a little bit, and I get it. Because during the pandemic, you know, the first year, they went full virtual, and everybody loved it. And they've been cutting back ever since. And, you know, Sundance is really a destination film festival. And it really is, once again, I could tell this year was a real comeback. So they didn't have any of their big debuts in virtual, but there's still plenty of movies to find. And, you know, at $20 a pop, it's not cheap, but you're not going to see these movies anywhere else. So if you're an addict like me, it's still fun. I only saw three this year, and I'm going to I'll talk about two because I really like them. You know, first up is Erica Tremblay's Fancy Dance, which is an Indigenous people's coming-of-age story, and that's the kind of thing that's right up my alley. It's a story about growing up on the res and missing women, and it's a familiar one, but it's very well told. And it builds to one of the best finishes I've seen this year. The real reason to see this one, though, is for Lily Gladstone, who is already a star in this movie. She's going to be a superstar in Killers of the Flower Moon, if that Scorsese movie ever comes out. She is the Indigenous lead in that movie, and she's super here. The other one is one I wanted to love, but really liked quite a bit, was Randall Park's feature directing debut, Shortcomings. Everybody knows Randall Park from, you know, Fresh Off the Boat. And he was also one of my favorite romantic comedies, always be my maybe. And this is a romantic comedy of sorts, too, based on the graphic novel by Adrian Tomine, who also wrote the script. And the story is about young Asian Americans growing in Berkeley, California, about their lives and loves. And really, you should watch this one for the performances, most notably from Justin Lin, Ali Mackie, and Sherry Cola. It's funny and insightful, but I really like this because the had an unlikable protagonist who by the end gets his comeuppance and is done pretty cleverly. And finally, you know, there's no word on when these will hit streaming, but I was happy to see that two of the big acquisitions this year both sound really good. The Me Too kind of drama thriller Fair Play, which I wanted to see but didn't get to, was swept up by Netflix. And my number two movie that I want to see for the entire year, John Carney's charmer Flora and Son, is headed to Apple Plus. They were both swooped up for about $20 million. So it's this new world. They, you know, I don't know that Netflix will put this in theaters at all, but, you know, Coda, which was also on Apple Plus, had a short theater run. So Flora and Son might, but those are the big acquisitions. And overall, you know, I hope they still keep some streaming because I still had fun this year at Sundance.
All right, so let's talk about some movies that we saw in theaters that have a wide release. Not even theaters, but we're going to talk about movies that just have a wide release now. And so let's go to You People, the Netflix movie comedy. Again, that's kind of headlined by Jonah Hill and Eddie Murphy. But let me kick it over to Brad first to explain a little bit more of the plot.
Summary, as always, courtesy of IMDb, follows a new couple and their families who find themselves examining modern love and family dynamics amidst clashing cultures, societal expectations, and generational differences.
Okay, so before even Keith gets into it, it's a long cast, so let me just, if you're curious, Laura London, David Duchovny, Nia Long, Julie Louis-Dreyfus, who else here? Elliot Gould, Rhea Perlman, Mike Epps, there's just a bunch of people, Lala Anthony. Mm-hmm. So, Keith, you saw this movie, so what's up?
Well, you know, the summary that Brad delivered is spot on for a much better movie. You know, if that's what movies could have been. I went into this on Netflix with high hopes for many reasons. As Ben said, you know, I think the biggest two stars in are Eddie Murphy and Julie Louis-Dreyfus. And you can't get better than that. But also, you know, I've watched every episode of Kenya Barris's Blackish. And I've even stuck with Grownish, you know, the college spinoff, which I really like, which is now on its rather remarkable sixth season on Freeform. I really like Jonah Hill, too. So when I saw this was written by Kenya Barris and Jonah Hill, and I think directed by Kenya Barris, I had high hopes, but unfortunately, given that pedigree and star power, this, if you can see my air quotes, comedy, you can't see them, I know, but it fails in almost every turn.
It's there. Trust us, we saw it. There's air quotes there.
So. It's not only a remake or update on the true classic Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but we don't get Sidney Poitier, Katharine Hepburn, or Spencer Tracy here, or sadly, any of that dark wit that made that movie very good. In this version, it's set in contemporary L.A., and Hill plays a queer podcaster, so I could dig that, on a show with co-host Sam Jay, which supposedly deals with racial issues in a comedic way. But that's where the supposed jokes just immediately fall flat. Instead, they just offend in the most unfunny way possible. As with the original movie, this is a romantic comedy at heart, and once Hill's Ezra meets Lauren London's Amira, there's no real chemistry, but I like Lauren London, and she does give this at least movie the only thing it has that's close to a spark. It all leads up to, as fans of the original will know, the big dinner where their parents all meet. And you can't get much better for star power. On one side is Eddie Murphy and Nia Long. On the other side, Julie Louis-Dreyfus and David Duchovny. So this is where The Witch should really shine, but instead it just goes faster and faster into the most broad racial and religious stereotypes. It didn't do anything for me. There's a lot of other stars here, as Ben said, but I really won't entice you to do any reason to watch this. But this is somehow currently the number one movie on Netflix. I'd say avoid it, but one thing that did make me laugh was David Duchovny's singular obsession with the rapper and custom car expert Exhibit. That's at least very funny. It's a running joke through the movie, but that's really the only one. A much smarter movie, which really would have hewed to Brad's subscription or, you know, IMDb's subscription, would have at least delivered a spoof of these racial stereotypes, but instead it just traffics in them in the lowest way possible. It's a real shame because a better flick on this subject would have been welcome right now. I was thinking about giving this 1.5 stars for the actual stars in it, but they don't add anything to it. And, you know, if you just want to laugh, House Party is a much better movie, the remake. I gave that 2 stars. Al has sadly can only give this 1 star. Which, like I said, I like Kenya Barris, I like all these people. This is a real miss.
All right. So why don't we just jump into the Rotten Tomatoes then? I guess we'll save the box office till after we talk about our second movie.
Well, I'm not going to pay him yet. Critics and audience, Keith. You want to take a crack?
Yeah, I didn't peek at this one, but I know it's not going to be good. I will go 60 for the critics, and I'll go a little higher for the fans. Let's go 65.
A little high, Keith. Critics, 42%, 113 reviews. Mm-hmm. Audience, 38%, 1,000-plus reviews.
So. Well, I always like to stay on the positive, but those people are dead on. This movie is atrocious.
Well, before we move on, you got critics' consensus?
I do, yes, Ben. Critics' consensus, as courtesy of Rotten Tomatoes. You People has an outstanding cast and plenty of comedic potential, both mostly wasted on a picture that dithers between social commentary and romantic comedy without fully committing to either.
Plus, it's highly offensive and not in any good way possible.
Okay. All right, so let's not waste any more time talking about this movie. So let's go ahead and move on to the main movie that opened this week, and that's M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin, which is a apocalyptic psychological horror film that's based on The Cabin at the End of the World by Paul G. Tremblay. From 2018. Let's kick it over to Brad first for the summary, and I can tell you a little bit more about who is in this movie. So, Brad?
Summary, as always, courtesy of IMDb. While vacationing, a girl and her parents are taken hostage by armed strangers who demand that the family make a choice to avert the apocalypse.
Okay. Pretty good summary.
So, if you've seen the trailer, that pretty much describes it. And this movie has Dave Bautista, Jonathan Groff from Mindhunters, also the voice of Kristoff from Frozen, among mm-hmm. other things. Ben Aldridge, Nikki Amuka Bird, Kristen Coy, Abby Quinn, and then, of course, we mentioned Rupert Grint. M. Night Shyamalan's movies, Keith and I were talking about that. He's got about a 50% hit rate, more or less.
I think you're being a little generous. I looked at them all, and I've seen them all. Well, to me, you know, hit would be great to nearly great. I would say there's 5. You're right, maybe 50% good. But yeah, they're definitely hit or miss.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the good ones in a second. But when the movie finished, and I was walking down the theater with Keith, and we were discussing, like, M. Night Shyamalan's movies, the concepts are always great. It's just the levels of execution vary from movie to movie. I think this is one of his better ones. You know, it's very taunt. Maybe it is because it's based on some source material. You know, at an hour and 40 minutes long, he doesn't really waste a lot of time. We jump right into the story. Like with any Shyamalan movie, you're just kind of waiting for something to happen or what the twist is. I enjoyed it. I'm skeptical, but I enjoyed it. Maybe it's not as much as Keith will probably say, but it was solid. So, Keith?
Yeah, I can always tell when Ben likes a movie, but maybe not love it, because Ben likes the word solid, and, you know, it's good. Everybody should have a movie word. I did like it a little more than you, but you're right. You really have to give in a lot to the truly hokey premise. There's not really a twist in this one. there's just a premise that slowly evolves, and it is wackadoo. So we'll get into that in the spoilers. But you know, I, like I said earlier, I'm a completist, and I've seen them all except maybe After Earth, I think, and I haven't saw The Last Airbender, unfortunately. What I do appreciate is that he always makes his movies from the heart, and this one, you know, he really did. You can tell. And for that, I really appreciate it. And, you know, Ben is right. The tension is what makes this one really good. We jump right to it with when Leonard, you know, Batista's character, meets the young girl played by Kristen Kwee. And they meet, and, you know, they're right outside the cabin. And then the action after that, except for some cleverly timed flashbacks, is almost all at the cabin. So the tension is very high, and he's clearly... He's learned from himself through the years, and he knows how to use now camera angles and close-ups and different things that keep that tension even higher. And, you know, he's worked with them. I enjoy all his work on Servant, and he's clearly learned from that. You know, there are horror masters who work on Servant. There's Julia Ducournau and others. And Ben is right. He's very, very good when he works with Mother Source material. I've not read this book, but I've talked to people who have. And it apparently has even more of an edge. But, you know, good cast. And if you go along with it, I even enjoyed the twist at the end. Just really solid movie, as Ben would say.
Yeah, Batista is kind of the headliner. We've had this discussion before. I think in the last 20 years, he's probably the best overall actor coming out of the wrestling world. I think the top three are him, John Cena, and The Rock. But I think he has the greatest range, and we've seen it. The Blade Runner movie... Even his comedies like My Spy, which I enjoyed. And, of course, you know, he can do the action part, too. Guardians of the Galaxy and some other stuff, too. But, I think what I appreciated, too, is that it's like a simple premise, but he just tries to do the best he can with it. And in some ways, this movie could almost be a play because, like Keith said, it is basically set inside a cabin almost the entire time. And the nagging question, this conceit, which basically is what, you know, Brad said, is that, you know, these people, these strangers have approached these folks who are enjoying their time in the cabin, and they're just like, look, if you don't do this thing, the world's going to end. Mm-hmm. That is the tension for the movie and for us as viewers being like, is this real or not, right? And, of course, the people who are being kidnapped are very skeptical, just like we would be. Ben Aldridge, I think, gets the most out of, you know, because Ben Aldridge and Jonathan Groff are the two parents in this. But Ben Aldridge... gets the most story, he gets the most backstory, and he's kind of the second lead, I think, and he's pretty solid in it. But
yeah, Groff is very good too. You have to give in a lot to M. Night Shyamalan's premise because he's asking you to decide, you know, this is a gay couple with a young child, and one of them has to die to save the world. Now, I'm not giving too much away there because that's really the premise.
Yeah.
And if that offends you, I understand, but we'll get into it later. The way he pitches it, if you give in, it really kind of works. Other people who are very good, you know, Rupert Grint is not in this very long, but he gives it some menace. And, you know, I really appreciated watching Rupert Grint as he comes along. Daniel Radcliffe has had a real run lately. Emma Watson had the most success early. She's still doing well. Well, Rupert Grint has his own horror lane developing. He's on Servant 2, and he was really good in this. Yeah, Ben's right. It really could be a play, but, you know, I appreciated that you have to give in more and more to it as it gets more and more crazy. You know, the Doomsday approach is plays well with the TV, and there's a lot of coincidences, which we really shouldn't get into to take the spoilers off. But, yeah, I really like how it was put together. Even the structure with the... Except when they're not in the cabin, they do timely flashbacks. And one of those dominates the trailer, to not spoil it too much, but that, so when you see it happen later, it's very cleverly structured. So that's something that M. Night doesn't always do very well. And for that, we'll get into it. I'd say this is in top five of his movies. We'll rank them later, but this is a really good one.
I guess real quick, we should do that, and then we can do the ratings, because obviously ranking his movies doesn't spoil anything, and there's some major spoilers that we need to talk about. But right out of the gate, right, his first two movies are just straight bangers, right? Sixth Sense and Unbreakable.
Yeah, I would put Unbreakable number one, but definitely 1-2.
Yeah, yeah. So those, you know, Split, and what was... Split, it's fine.
Signs
is also very solid. Split, and then what was the sequel? The one that kind of tied Unbreakable. Glass.
Yeah, I like Glass more than you, but I would say, just to put in perspective, those are, I agree with you, those are the five, including this one. Yeah. I'd say there was five good ones. I would put this number three behind his first two. So I really liked it. Signs, Split is, if you know, is great for many reasons, but that this one is right up there.
Okay, so this is number three all time for you for M. Night Shyamalan. So what's your rating then?
I was gonna go four. I will, because that's how my personal enjoyment. I'll go 3.5 because you really have to give into the premise, and some people won't. But I will give it an affectionate 3.5 stars.
That's what I figured you would, and you're right. I didn't like it as much, so I will reflect that in my grade, which is a 3. If you want to just be entertained and you want kind of a horror movie that's not like slasher, or, you know, we saw some trailers for what, an Evil Dead movie and everything like that, which was much more conventionally scary. But there's just like, there's a tension there. Even the violence, for the most part, is kind of off screen. I mean, but that's the M. Night Shyamalan. That's not like super graphic. So 3.5 for you, 3 for me. Why don't we do Rotten Tomatoes and all that stuff, and then we can get into spoilers.
Critics and audience. Ben, why don't you go first this time?
I'll go 73% for the critics. And the people in our showing Friday night clapped. A lot of people clapped. There wasn't a big crowd, but there was some applause there. So I'll go like 85 for the audience.
All right, Keith?
I will go 70 for the critics, and that's a little higher than the number I looked at earlier. Like I try not to do this, but I really am curious about M. Night movies, so I spoiled that rating for myself. I didn't look at the critics. I will go... sorry, I didn't look at the fans. I will go 75.
Okay. Critics, 69%, 212 reviews.
Nice.
Audience, 64%, 250-plus reviews. Okay. A little bit under.
That's not too surprising, given the premise. And M. Night, people go see his movies, but they don't always love them. So,
what is the critics' consensus?
And
right?
Critics' consensus, courtesy of Rotten Tomatoes. Although it's often less than scary and parts of the story don't bear scrutiny, Knock at the Cabin is a thought-provoking chiller and an upper-tier Shyamalan.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. Do we want to do box office real quick, and then we can talk about the spoilers? We'll close out
top
the spoilers.
Five. Do you all want to take a crack at number one?
I'm just going to guess Avatar.
I am going to guess, with my heart, Knock at the Cabin.
Keith, you would be correct. Knock at the Cabin, number one, $14.2 million this week.
Yeah.
Number two, the other debuting film, 80 for Brady, at $12.5 million. Avatar The Way of the Water slips to third, $10.8 million, 8-week total of $636.4 million.
Puss in Boots, number four?
If you can't see, Ben was doing kind of a Jedi mind
doing
thing
the
there.
I was doing like...
Oh, Karnak. Okay.
Or like, Karnak...
Kind of gives the envelope.
Yeah, the envelope.
I was like kind of like Professor X a little bit, I guess.
Puss in Boots, Last Wish, number four, $7.9 million, $151.2 million in 7 weeks total. And if you can get number five, Ben, I will give you a free cookie. I'll tell you right now, you ain't getting it.
No, because you told me what number six is, so I don't know what it is. So what's number five?
Number five is The Chosen, season three finale.
Oh, okay.
$7 million. Okay.
It's slow.
It beat out Megan and A Man Called Otto and some of the other stuff that have come out past.
It's interesting that they would run it now, but I guess maybe it's still like it's Christmas. Maybe the first it started around Christmas time, and this is episode three or whatever the heck you said.
Well, it's the season three finale, so I think it was episode 8 or 9.
For perspective, you know, I had a feeling this was going to be number one just because I saw the speculation might be. But Old, which I did not like, Shyamalan's last movie, it was somewhere in 15 to 20. So this is, you know, right in his ballpark, but a little disappointing. I think this one will have better staying power, though.
Okay, so why don't we do some spoilers?
Turn away! Run away now!
Okay, so let me give you some full spoilers in this movie. So, I mean, we have the conceit, right, that Ben Aldridge and Jonathan Groff and their adopted little girl, you know, they're faced with this choice, basically. It's like you have to, one of the three of you have to die. You have to choose in order to save humanity. So obviously they're skeptical. It doesn't happen. When they don't choose, one of the folks that are the kind of occupiers, they have to die. And with that, also, you just get more... like weird things happening. So it feels like it's true. It feels like it's actually true. Like these people who were, they said they have visions and they randomly came together for this cabin are telling the truth. So I wanted to ask you, Keith, like, were you still waiting maybe for a, you know, because M. Night Shyamalan obviously is known for a twist. Were you still waiting for another twist? Like,
you know, I wasn't, only because he's kind of given up on that in recent years. He knows that was his gimmick, but also, M. Night Shyamalan, and this will turn some people off, it does. He always plays around with religion and ideas of hope and love, even as dark, well, it's not as dark as movies like Split, But this one, he takes it to the brink. You know, to get into it, full spoilers, you know, the couple finally come to believe, and I, you know, it was M. Night's premise, I do too, that these are the four horses of the apocalypse. And the reason they're asked to make this sacrifice is that they are the ideal of true love. So if they make the sacrifice for the world will see that and heal itself. That's a lot to swallow. At least that's how I read it. And if you look at it too closely, you know, he's asking one half of a gay couple to kill themselves. But if you're that literal, don't go see an M. Night Shyamalan movie anyway. It's a hokey idea, and that's why, you know, I don't know, I don't speak for Ben, but he might have had some more problem with it. But I just went along with it, and I know M. Night Shyamalan does weird stuff. This is one that I appreciated.
I just thought maybe once that choice happens that, you know, it would kind of reset, and then, you know, again, spoilers, you know, Jonathan Groff's character, that one half of that couple, basically says, go ahead and sacrifice mm-hmm. me. I thought maybe once that happened and when the apocalypse was averted that maybe he would come back, or, you know, there would be some sort of, it would be like, okay, this is your reward for being so selfless that, you know, but I didn't like the ending. I didn't like the ending, you know, in the trailer. There's a scene where the family's driving to the cabin and they're playing Casey and Sunshine Band, mm-hmm. Boogie Shoes. And they play that at the end. It just ruined the tone of the movie for me. It's basically, it's up there with Remember the Titans as far as, like, they ruined the movie with a bad musical choice. And it wasn't funny. Nobody in our theater laughed. No. It just kind of was a weird vibe. They didn't need to do that part.
That's what M. Night does. He always has one misstep. For me, it wasn't a huge misstep because I wanted it to have that semi-happy ending. I, you know, if he had taken it as far as Ben said, that Jonathan Groff's character came back, that would have been too much for me. But we've already given in this far, so if he had done that, I wouldn't have been too surprised.
Really? I mean, you know, if you know, you talk about religious, right? I mean, again, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say like Jonathan Groff's character is like Jesus, but I mean, the same way where, you know, he made the ultimate sacrifice and then he's rewarded for that. And
they're tying with it. He's definitely toying with that idea. Yeah. And that's a lot to swallow. If you like your religion straight up, and people should, you'll be offended by this. But I like that he toys around with ideas.
Yeah.
And he often misses, but this one he almost entirely lands.
Yeah. So... Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to discuss that's spoiler-free? And I'll tell you what the differences are from the book.
Okay, I was going to ask if you did, because I've read some things about them.
Because the book... Okay, yeah, so basically what Keith says is true. The Four Horsemen, you know, it's the people that approach this couple. And again, each time they do not make a decision, one of the horsemen basically has to pay the price. And the others kill one person at a time, with our guy Rupert Grint being the first one to get killed. Dave Bautista is just like, look, guys, like every time you don't make a choice, this has to happen. And, you know, another part of the apocalypse continues. And as they watch the news, it continues to escalate. You know, you have flooding. Planes are literally falling from the sky. Just a bunch of other stuff that's happening. They continue not to make the decision. So, okay, so there's a point in the movie where Ben Aldridge's character is able to get free, and he runs out of the cabin, and he gets into their truck where he has a gun. And in some ways, this is where it diverges from the book. So in the movie, two of the apocalypse people have already died, I think, because they haven't made a decision. Ben Aldridge's character gets the gun. He shoots another apocalypse person, and then it's just them and Dave Bautista. And again, Dave Bautista is very insistent on that.
Yeah.
They don't make a decision in the right amount of time. So Dave Bautista basically kills himself. He's like, look, when I die, you guys are going to have about 5 minutes to decide what's happening, or this apocalypse is really going to happen. And it's at that point where Jonathan Groff's character is like, I see this, I understand it, I believe it's real, you need to sacrifice me. And he does.
And they kind of teasing that because he sees a light through the window. Yeah. There's a lot of religious
early.
Elements here.
He's concussed during the initial mm-hmm. struggle. He is in concussion. So, well, is he seeing it, or maybe he's just not? He's physically not there because, you know, he took a bump to the head. Where it diverges from the book, Keith, is okay. So everything's the same until the gun thing happens,
okay.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the apocalypse people was shot. So there's two apocalypse people left, right? So in this scenario, the woman who's a little bit more religious, she's like, I can't do this anymore. So they kill Dave Bautista's character. And then, so there's a struggle. One of the apocalypse people dies. the religious lady's like, this is, one of the religious people dies, and the child is accidentally shot and killed, okay?
Oh, my
God. So it's just the two parents, Batista, so, hold so on, it's just the two parents, Batista, and the religious person. The religious person, at this point, she's like, I can't believe in this anymore. So, you know, they kill Batista, she kills Batista's character, Leonard, and she lets the other, she lets the two parents go away, free, but she's like, the apocalypse, because that girl, little girl, died accidentally, the apocalypse is still going to happen, so it's still going to be up to you guys. And then she kills herself, much like Batista does.
Wow.
But then, the non-Shyamalan twist is that the couple's like, we can't do it. Like, we, like, whatever's going to happen is whatever happens. So they just let the apocalypse happen, and that's how the book ends. So,
wow.
So it's very different.
It is.
Very different.
But I can appreciate that that was not a Shyamalan kind of ending.
M. Night Shyamalama type shit.
He made it his own.
Yeah.
And I can see why. I didn't know this from what you said, that they didn't let the guy who wrote the book, you know, get his hands on it.
Yeah.
Because that is much different. It's much darker.
I could see where maybe they filmed it and the test audience is like, no, this isn't good. Like, because, you know, you can't kill a little girl.
I don't know. I think this movie fits well in the way Shyamalan looks at the world. So I wouldn't be surprised if he...
Well, which ending would you have preferred? The movie ending or the book ending?
I prefer this ending. Yeah. I need a little heart. We don't need to hear Boogie Shoes again, yeah. But I want there to be a resolution of some kind. And there doesn't really have to be.
Yeah.
But in a movie with this wild a premise... there has to be some kind of resolution, and I appreciate that. There is a resolution in the book, the way you describe it, too. The apocalypse comes. That wouldn't have sat well with me, the way this was set up. You know?
So, but, yeah, that was basically it. So, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan, so.
You know, if you like horror movies, like Ben said, it's January. Go see it.
Yeah.
You know, Meg, just start in February.
February. It's that time of year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, if you want a little traditional horror, I mean, you have that Evil Dead movie coming out. Megan is still in theaters, I think. Probably, again, it's good timing. I think HBO or somebody was showing Signs. Mm-hmm. So, if you have a taste for M. Night Shyamalan, mm-hmm. you can find it on the streaming. So,
plus, since these guys begged me to, The Last of Us is first quality television.
You finally watched it, yes.
It is cinematic.
I told you,
I've seen two episodes.
So you haven't seen... Oh, well, the third one.
I haven't
one.
Seen number three yet.
You Ooh. Should watch that. That's
the third one probably, bar none, is probably the best of the three so
it
far.
It might be... So. There's some hyperbole, but part of me believes it, but, you know, people are saying it is, like, literally one of the best episodes in TV. Like, period.
I can see that. You know, the bar is very high for oddball HBO series. Leftovers is one of the best things I've ever seen. And their single season of Watchmen is perfection. Right. So the standards are high. Episode one didn't hook me entirely. It was very good. Episode two is even better, so I can't wait for episode three.
Yes, well, okay, so we got the box office, we got Rotten Tomatoes, we got everything else, spoilers, so I think it's time to wrap this episode up. So Keith, where can they find us?
All right, we are at moviesandemealog@gmail.com, moviesandemeal on Twitter, and do give us a listen on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, all right. So I think for this episode of Movies in a Meal, I'm Ben.
And Keith.
It's Brad. Peace.